Set your course for the Huff
Takes Podcast.
Hello and welcome to the latest episode of Huff Takes Podcast. I'm Grace Seegers.
And I'm Eric Geller.
And we are sadly missing one of our fellow co-hosts, Haley Bird Wilt, who will not be joining us this episode, but Eric and I are presumably more than capable of handling a discussion on our own. We shall see if that is indeed the case. So today's episode, we are going to be talking about A New Hope, episode 4 of the Star Wars saga. And pretty much it's difficult to say anything new about A New Hope. Get it? Because there is
because it has new in its name. Yeah.
Yes, indeed. Yeah. It was a bit tricky, but I'm glad you got it. So it's basically impossible to say anything new about A New Hope because it came out 44 years ago now, and it seems like everything that can be said has been said, but that will not prevent us from valiantly trying to say anything new. To say something new anyway, or at the very least, say something old, but hopefully in an interesting and fun way. So the way I kind of envisioned this discussion is talking about A New Hope within the context of the wider Star Wars universe. So understanding it as episode 4, coming in pretty much smack dab in the middle of the so-called Skywalker saga, and within the greater universe of all of the movies, TV shows, books, comics, etc., etc. And then I'd also like to talk about it without the context of the greater Star Wars universe. So looking at this as the first Star Wars film ever made, the one that started it all, pretending that we know absolutely nothing about the Star Wars universe, how effective of a movie is this? Of an introduction into the greater universe as a whole. So with that in mind, I'm going to start off our conversation looking at A New Hope within the context of the Star Wars universe. So Eric, pretending that this isn't the first movie made and pretending that it wasn't made in 1977 and therefore has very different special effects from later movies, how effective do you think this is as an entry compared to other Star Wars movies?
Well, because it was the first one that was made, but I guess, you know, pretending that isn't at play, it makes you exclude a major part of why it is such a good introduction, which is that it was created for people who didn't have any background knowledge because there wasn't any. So it explains everything that needs to be explained, but it also does that classic, you know, sort of George Lucas early success, one of the things for which he was correctly lauded, which is it leaves you wanting to know a lot more, but it doesn't hold back the kinds of things that today people might say are plot holes or are sort of unsatisfying voids. There's a lot of discussion about, in fact, I was just having a Twitter conversation, was it yesterday or the day before, about the dagger from The Rise of Skywalker. And you know, is it stupid? Is it smart? Does it need to be explained? What is, you know, Ochi's deal? Blah, blah, blah. Well, A New Hope doesn't have a lot of things like that where, in my opinion anyway, that dagger needed more. It was just a little bit too weird. There were just a few too many blanks that were not filled in. I don't think A New Hope has that problem. And part of the reason for that is it was created with, you know, with the understanding that there is no brand loyalty yet. And so I know that I'm disobeying the rules of this hypothetical here, but that is such a huge part of why it works. If you didn't know that it was the first one, if you were told watch these movies in chronological order, and if someone lied to you and said that's how they were made, I think that you would come away thinking there is something different about this one. Was it a different director, different writer? You would have questions about the production process because it does stand out in that way. It does have those hints of things like the Clone Wars, but it hits that balance really well of explaining what needs to be explained.
Yes, thank you for completely overturning my question and answering a question that I didn't ask. Appreciate it. No, I'm totally kidding. It is important to discuss A New Hope within context because it was the first one and it had to reel you into this universe without any prior knowledge. So by saying, let's pretend that we don't know it was created first and we're just looking at it from within the context of the larger Star Wars universe, I mean, it's a really hard question because everything we know about it has that important piece of context added to it. So when you look at the maybe special effects that aren't quite as impressive by today's standards, or the kind of, I'm going to be harsh, the kind of lame lightsaber battle between Darth Vader and Obi-Wan, you think to yourself, well, this was made in 1977, it was revolutionary for its time, et cetera, et cetera. Of course, it can't be compared to the lightsaber battles of the best ones of the prequels or of the sequels. So it's very difficult to kind of take it out of one context, which is this is the first one ever made and was made in 1977, and put it into another context, which is how does this movie compare to the other Star Wars stories? And something that I think is interesting when you look at it from solely from the larger Star Wars universe perspective is how kind of simple of a story it is compared to some of the other movies, including some of the movies in the original trilogy. Like, it's just a hero, very simple hero's journey, farm boy. As the Disney Plus description of the movie is something like, a farm boy receives a message from Princess Leia. And that, I mean, that's basically what kicks off the whole movie and boiled down is the plot. So, Eric, how do you feel about the simplicity of this movie as compared to some of the others? Like, no trade disagreements in this one.
Yeah, I mean, I gotta say that when I, you know, whenever you rewatch this movie, the big thing that you take away when you've seen Star Wars as many times as I have, you know, all the various movies, is, wow, like, no trade disputes in this one. Like, you really feel that absence, and it's almost, you know, it almost drives you to want to re-edit it and maybe add in some Nemoidians in the background. You know, I think, listen, it was, you know, there's two ways to analyze this, you know, like your question earlier, right? If you look at it in context, it's obvious that the goal here was to tell a Buck Rogers, you know, fairy tale story with the space fantasy layer on top of it. And so you have to keep the story very simple. If you look at it in sort of the context of the broader Star Wars universe, I mean, this is also a time where a lot of these sort of the Republic era sort of minutiae and nuance and stuff like that has been swept away by this power struggle, this broader conflict between good and evil. And so thematically, you know, if you watch this story in order, and again, if you somehow don't know when these movies were made, if you watch chronologically, you get to episode four, it has this sort of, I don't know, after you watch Revenge of the Sith and everybody dies and the Republic falls and there's this great wiping clean of the slate, A New Hope is almost like starting to reset the table, putting things back on the table, having this broad dynamic of good versus evil, but it isn't complicated because in many ways you just have the rebirth of this, of the light side going up against this counterweight, you know, force, the dark side. And it's not a time for the kinds of nuances that, you know, that you could sort of pick apart in the prequels when the state of the galaxy was different. This is very much like, you know, the light side clawing its way back up and being reborn. And again, you know, you can look at The Force Awakens in a similar context where, yes, out of universe, we know they're just setting the table again for this trilogy. But in universe, it does feel a little bit like the light side is starting to wake up again. There isn't that yet established sort of institutional, you know, Jedi Order or anything like that. And so it makes sense to me that it is as simple as it is. And that is obviously sort of a philosophical retcon, if you will, because that's not the reason that it's simple. But I think in context, it does sort of feel right.
I actually would agree with you there. And I think specifically the reason it feels right is because it's from the perspective of Luke, who, I mean, he basically knows nothing. He's just some loser on Tatooine. No offense, Luke.
Wow.
He's a fictional character. He can't hear me roasting him. But if it had been told from like Leia's perspective, which again would not have happened because it was 1977, but if it had, it would have necessarily needed to be more complex because she had been involved in the rebellion for essentially her whole life and raised to be a rebellion asset, which is a fascinating kind of character development that I believe deserves to be explored on its own. But since it's from the perspective of Luke, it makes sense that the audience would just be looking at it from new eyes, from the eyes of this 19-year-old kid who is just realizing now that there's a wider universe out there that he wants to be a part of. So I mean, yes. I do think... Go ahead.
I was just going to say, think about the cantina scene, right? That scene doesn't happen if Leia is the main character. And obviously Leia is not on Tatooine at the time, but what I mean is she knows the galaxy. She's been out there. So walking into a cantina with all these weird aliens isn't this sort of this revelation to her in the way that it is to Luke. So the audience would never have that moment of, wow, look at what's happening in Star Wars with all these aliens. This is such a wacky place. Like for Luke, he is discovering something there. Right now, he's in Star Wars, so he knows that aliens exist. So it's not like us, where for us, the reveal is like, oh my God, look at what they can do with the prosthetics. And like, this is cool just because we haven't seen this in film before, right? So that is the reveal to us. To Luke, it is, look at the ways in which all these people can come together. Look at the diversity of this place. I have not yet seen, you know, this kind of thing before. And so that you get that feeling through Luke. You can share to some degree, at least, in that feeling of discovery through Luke. To your point, Leia has already discovered all that. So Star Wars A New Hope with Leia as the main character doesn't proceed along that same line of like, look at this coming now to a theater near you. You know, all those scenes that you have to have Star Wars be Star Wars in 1977, Leia would not be experiencing those scenes in that way.
Right, exactly. And looking at it from the perspective of the larger universe, let's say that you're watching it all chronologically, and you've just seen Rogue One, too, which is basically the opening credits scrawl of A New Hope. So let's say you've just seen Rogue One, and you're like, yeah, I get it. I understand the Empire, good guys, bad guys, how the Death Star plans get into rebellion hands, yada, yada. So it makes sense that you would get a new perspective on the story as a whole. And I think one of the more brilliant aspects of A New Hope is how it focuses on Luke. Because I think the prequels, and in particularly The Phantom Menace, kind of flagged a bit, in part because they didn't start with a central protagonist to focus on. Like, ostensibly, that protagonist would be Anakin, who we meet as an adorable 9-year-old boy with a bowl cut. But he's not really the focus of The Phantom Menace. He's more of an ancillary character, which is a bit weird considering that he's supposed to be the protagonist of the whole trilogy. But in A New Hope, you have Leia, who's great, and you have Han, who's fine, and all of these extra characters, introduction to Obi-Wan, introduction to Darth Vader. But Luke really is the heart of the movie, and that can be seen in the famous Twin Suns scene, where Luke is looking out at the binary sunset, and the music swells, and there's that close-up of Mark Hamill's face, and you, the audience, just feel the longing that Luke has to join the larger universe. And, I mean, it gets me every time, tingles every time. But the entirety of A New Hope is really wrapped into that one instant of looking at the universe from the perspective of this boy who doesn't know anything else but wants to know more. And I think that's something where the A New Hope really succeeds narratively, is by focusing on Luke and on Luke's journey in a way that the other movies, the other introductory movies, The Phantom Menace and The Force Awakens, I don't think did as successfully, particularly not The Phantom Menace.
Yeah, I mean, it is sort of, if you think about, there, as you said, there's no main character in The Phantom Menace. And one of the reasons that I think The Force Awakens also succeeds so well is that it sets up similar motifs with Rey. And, you know, we've talked about how it's very, very, very similar to A New Hope, or at least many people think so. So it's not surprising that it would set up similar motifs all the way down to, you know, the character having that moment of longing, you know, looking out into the sky. But it really does help to be able to look at things through Luke's eyes. And there's a lot of really interesting camera choices in A New Hope as well that emphasize that you're seeing things in a lot of cases through Luke's eyes. You know, one example is on the Death Star when he and Leia and Han encounter Vader and Obi-Wan dueling. The camera is, there are obviously close-ups on Vader and Obi-Wan, but there are also some shots that are interesting that I don't know that you would have had necessarily in later movies from across the docking bay, from where Luke and Leia and Han are standing, watching the fight from across the docking bay. It's not a tight shot. You're not getting as much detail as you would in a tight shot, but it emphasizes that this is really a moment of discovery for Luke. This is the first time that he has seen any, you know, people dueling with lightsabers, one lightsaber on another. It's also the first time that he's seen Darth Vader. It's the first time that he's seen his mentor face off against someone, you know, more than, you know, Ponda Baba. I'm sorry, Ponda Baba, but you're not much of a threat. And so it's this moment of sort of triple discovery for him. And the choice of, you know, the cinematography emphasizes that to a large extent, you do watch that scene through Luke's eyes. And, you know, of course, Obi-Wan is in a sense performing for Luke, buying him time, and also showing him how, yes, you can be cut down, but that doesn't mean you're gone. Luke hears him a second later. So there is a performance there for Luke. And it's emphasizing the fact that this is Luke's story and pretty much everything else in that movie revolves around him.
Right. Yeah, I would say that's a good breakdown of that scene and something I had jotted down in my notes as well. Speaking of Darth Vader, something that I find really interesting every time I watch A New Hope is that he's a bad guy, but he's not necessarily as big of a threat as he is in the Empire Strikes Back and in Return of the Jedi. He's more of a bureaucratic evil wizard. It seems more like he's Moff Tarkin's creature than his own bad guy. There's one part where Leia says in her hilariously weird accent that Tarkin is holding Vader on his leash. And I think that within the larger universe, pretending that we were watching it chronologically, that would be a bit of a bummer to go through the first trilogy setting up Darth Vader as this big bad, than if you had watched like Rebels and watched Rogue One and the best scene in Rogue One, which is Vader cutting down a bunch of rebels mercilessly in a super cool and dramatic way. And then you watched A New Hope. I mean, it'd be kind of a bummer. Really? He's not that big of a threat in A New Hope. So what do you think of the character of Vader in this movie?
Never heard of him. No. It's interesting. How many minutes would you estimate Darth Vader gets on screen in A New Hope?
Not many.
So this is a 121-minute movie, according to IMDb. Vader is on screen for 9 minutes and 15 seconds.
What, really?
Yeah. And if you look across all three movies, so 121 minutes, 124 minutes, 131 minutes, that's the original trilogy. Darth Vader is on screen for about 36, 37 minutes total in the entire trilogy. That's pretty incredible for multiple reasons. One of them is that it emphasizes how great the performance is and how great everything around the performance is. You know, the other characters talking about him, the music. It emphasizes that he looms large over the story, even if he's not on screen as much as you'd expect. It's incredible to me because, yes, you watch the prequels, you get Vader at the end. Vader at the end of Revenge of the Sith is, if you're watching chronologically, doesn't have the power of if you watch it in terms of release order, where it's like, oh, there he is, there's the guy, this is how he becomes the guy, right? You see it happen, but you don't necessarily have that strong feeling about how cool it is to see it happen, because you don't really particularly need to know. It's not like you went into with the Phantom Menace saying, I need to know how he becomes Vader. So it happens, you get Rebels, he's cool in Rebels. Again, judicious use of Darth Vader in Rebels. Yes. And you get to A New Hope, and yeah, I mean, if you had fallen in love with Darth Vader at that point because of how cool he was when he was on screen, he does feel a little bit like, you know, the henchman enforcer of Grand Moff Tarkin in that first movie. But then, and you know, obviously we'll talk about the, you know, Empire Strikes Back and Return of the Jedi at some future point, but like, yeah, it's interesting how in this movie he's very much on the leash, and he doesn't, like, Tarkin is able to basically say, you're being absurd, how could Obi-Wan be alive? Like, you're the last one from that ancient religion. You know, nobody talks to Darth Vader that way in the rest of the original trilogy. And
right.
This is the only time, and not in Rebels either, which sort of raises some interesting questions about, like, well, if by the time of A New Hope he's still on a leash, why isn't he necessarily treated that way in Rebels? But it is interesting that in A New Hope, he doesn't yet have the prominence that he has in the popular imagination. I mean, sure, he can almost kill a guy at a meeting, right? But Tarkin is able to stop him. Now, imagine that happening on any other occasion with the rest of the trilogy. It's hard to picture Vader stepping down like that, backing off like that. And it's just really interesting to look back at him after seeing what he becomes both in the rest of the Star Wars saga and also in pop culture. He's shockingly not, you know, playing, you know, true to his sort of stereotype in this movie. But at the same time, the movie tries to make it clear that he is a force to be reckoned with, you know, pun intended. He gets that great entrance scene. And, you know, there's, you know, in later movies, you see more of him sort of using the Force, but he is physically, you know, visually distinct from the stormtroopers and the hallways of the blockade runner. I mean, he gets that visual power and presence. But in terms of his interactions with other characters, yeah, you're right. I mean, he's not necessarily the Vader that we come to know in the rest of the saga.
Yeah, I mean, even the music isn't quite as commanding as it comes to be in the next movies, like the Imperial March, the famous dun 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 dun, dun. That doesn't show up until Empire Strikes Back, and that's one of the huge audio cues that has become associated with Vader. So it's interesting to see his character in this movie, both as a significant threat, but kind of seeming like a secondary one. And something I would say maybe that would explain the on a leash thing is that he's only on a leash as it pertains to like Moff Tarkin and the Death Star, because it seems like obviously the highest authority is the Emperor, and then Tarkin is the one who's now in control of the Death Star project, and Darth Vader is basically the Emperor's right-hand man who is kind of their supervising, but he's not the one in control of the project. That's Tarkin himself, and therefore, you know, why Tarkin ends up getting blown up, and why Tarkin is able to say, hey, stop talking about your weird religion and choking my officers in business meetings. That's an HR violation. So that's the only kind of in-universe explanation that I would give it. It's kind of a lame one, but, you know, Star Wars is all about explaining things, sometimes with to good effect, sometimes kind of lamely, and I'm okay if this is a kind of lame explanation for it.
Can you imagine, like, the Wall Street Journal story about, like, Darth Vader's, like, you know, harassment and, like, abusive behaviors? Like, you know, 34 Imperial lieutenants, you know, went on background to tell the journal about, you know, Vader frequently, you know, murdering their bosses in hallways and, like, you know, the effort, like, hashtag fire Vader.
Yeah, I mean, also talking about your religion and kind of, like, proselytizing about it during work hours, not very professional at all.
No, I mean, I think we, like, there have been articles about, like, the boss who, like, tells his employees, like, you need to join this religion, like, it, you know, you should donate to my church or whatever. Like, you know, Vader would have been extremely canceled by now for a lot of reasons. I do think you're right, though, about Tarkin, and, you know, the comics actually do a pretty good job of showing how Vader eventually gets more power, not only because Tarkin is dead, but also because the Death Star was a failure, right? So Tarkin's, you know, massive expenditure on this one project is proven to be a failure, and even if he had lived, he would have been diminished, and Vader would have been able to lean more on finding Luke and, you know, the sort of the projects that are priorities for him. And, of course, with this looming presence out of the way, he gets a freer hand, is able to, you know, to twist the Imperial fleet around finding Luke Skywalker, basically. And that's, you know, that's a large part of what we see in The Empire Strikes Back, where the Imperial March does debut, because that's sort of Vader in his prime, right? That is Vader Unleashed.
Exactly. And Vader Unleashed is what we all came here to see.
Yeah.
I am going to switch tacks a little bit. And we have sort of talked about this already, but I'd like to take a look at the movie from without the greater Star Wars universe context. So looking at it just as a movie, just as an entree into the larger universe, like pretend that we are sitting in the movie theater in 1977, credits just rolled, and now we're gonna, you know, go to cool 70s diner and talk about it. Or something. I don't know what people did in the 70s.
Yeah, no, that's pretty much it. They went to diners. They got into their, like, muscle cars, and they cruised over to, you know, the American Graffiti diner.
Exactly. See, I was just about to reference American Graffiti, which was George Lucas's prior work, and was about the 50s, but made in the 70s, so it counts. But anyway, Eric, pretending that, you know, we're sitting with our milkshakes at the 1970s diner, and, you know, I'm just asking you what you thought of that cool movie. Like, what do you think of that cool movie?
Well, you know, it's interesting because I might have mentioned this earlier, but one of the things that's really great about the movie is it takes you into this really weird world, but it doesn't overpower you with weird jargon. So, like, you know, Star Trek famously has the technobabble, right? It was an incredibly accessible TV show, but nonetheless, it was primarily mocked for, like, the biggest thing that people mock it for, aside from, I guess, like, the dogs in really bad costumes and, like, the weird Klingon forehead stuff, is the technobabble. And there is something serious about that underpinning the mockery, which is it can sometimes be off-putting to layer in the expectation that you have to understand what the characters, like, what these new and fake words that they're using mean in order to understand the story. And Star Trek did not always have that problem, but sometimes it did. Sometimes you were more focused on the techno babble than on the drama that was unfolding on screen, on the character arcs, etc. Star Wars doesn't really have that. There are some words, you know, Han, I think, you know, in the Falcon at one point says, you know, Nava computer, when he's talking about, you know, programming their course or whatever. And that's kind of an example of, okay, it's not a real word, but the brilliant thing about a lot of the stuff George Lucas came up with was you can understand what that is if you've even if you've never heard it before. It's a navigational computer. It's also used in context really well. So that movie doesn't do a lot of jargon, and when it does, it's pretty easily understandable jargon. So, you know, in the sort of expanded universe, there were these, you know, conversations about jargon because a bunch of writers decided to just start calling bathrooms refreshers instead of bathrooms, and which I think now they're using bathrooms again in canon. But
what,
you know,
really?
They would. I think so. So I know that they've used refresher once or twice. But
I just got used to refresher.
Well, man. This is the problem, right? Is now you're one of those, you know, give us legends people because, you know, you want to go back to the, you're a traditionalist when it comes to language. yeah, but like, and then they made up curse words, you know, for the, right. Criff. Criff is a classic example of, we know people swear no matter where they are. We're in a fictional universe. Let's give them fictional swear words. Han says, I'll see you in hell. In The Empire Strikes Back, and even though we're here talking about A New Hope, it supports my broader point of George, you know, we're best friends, was very good about balancing the fake words to describe things that are clearly fake technology, right? We don't have navicomputers. We have GPSs, but that's different. So you need something to describe what this thing is. Balancing those fake words, which are very accessible for the most part, and then balancing the kinds of words that we all use that draw you into the story so that you're not having to try to imagine being in that situation and using these fake words to describe these fake objects. You can use words that real people would use if this universe were real. And I think that's one of the things I would have noticed first after watching this movie is this doesn't feel like Star Trek to me. This feels a lot more like you just advance real world technology, but you keep the mythos, the drama of the real world, the way that it is. And real people are interacting in this way that it's believable to me. I can pretend that I'm there because I'm not being overwhelmed by the surreal, the hard sci-fi, if you will. So that would be one of my big takeaways is that it works really well as a space fantasy story.
Yeah. I mean, the classic reason, in my opinion, that you can't effectively compare Star Trek and Star Wars is because Star Trek is a sci-fi show. There is science. I mean, it's BS science, but there is science. And Star Wars is basically a fantasy. It's like, it takes place in space, but it's basically a fantasy, which is not a dig. I love that space opera fantasy. Something that I noticed this time around and that I'm sure I would have noticed if I were watching it for the first time with no greater context is how there's a lot of exposition, but it doesn't feel forced. I mean, the opening title scrawl is exposition dump, but it doesn't. It still expects you to catch up. So you're like, wait, whoa, there's a rebellion and an empire. And then there's a lot of kind of smaller asides throughout the movie. Like something that really drew my attention was how you get this whole exposition-y thing from Leia in her hologram message. And then Obi-Wan mentions the Clone Wars, and as a viewer, you're like, wait, what? What are the Clone Wars? But then they just move right along. They do not explain, you know, you remember the Clone Wars. They happened 20 years ago with this. They just, so it feels very lived in, even though they're dropping these, you know, exposition mentioning an Imperial Senate and
I was going to say, you know, the dissolution of the Imperial Senate. I mean, right. Imagine watching this movie in 1977 and being told that the entire sort of, you know, legislative branch of the Star Wars galaxy has just been swept away, a few decades after Hitler and during a time of discussion about, you know, of communism and, you know, lingering fascism. I mean, this is a time when people are very much aware of the kinds of things that can happen if you just completely disregard representative government And here we have that being just barely mentioned as an indicator of the consolidation of Imperial power, but we don't get any details about it.
And I think watching that for the first time, that would have really engaged me and left me wanting more. Like, ooh, now I want to know about the Clone Wars and the Galactic Senate. To which George Lucas would say, well, wait 20 years and I'll give you something very unsatisfying.
If you're excited about the the Senate, you just wait. And I've got a great trilogy. There's going to be trade negotiations. It's going to be great.
Is that what George Lucas sounds like?
Not really, but this is my impression of him.
Right. Yeah, I mean, like, I've heard him talk, but that's not one of your better impressions. You have some good ones, but...
Really? I do? Thank you.
I'm being nice.
Oh, okay.
But I think that's another example of how this movie is really good at bringing you into the universe by showing, not telling, as we discussed during the cantina scene, but also by giving you little hints of a larger universe and leaving it up to the audience to discern the rest. I think that was pretty clever of it, and it made it feel very lived in too. So I think it does a good job of introducing this universe that already feels very complete and like its own thing, even though this is only the first in presumably what is going to be a series of movies. I certainly assume they'll do a sequel. Something I want to ask you, Eric, is what do you think of kind of the pacing of the movie? Because I personally really love the first hour and a half, but, and I know this is blasphemy, I get pretty bored during the whole like trench running Death Star fighting scene. I feel like the movie flags in the third act. So what's your opinion on kind of the pacing of the movie as a whole?
I mean, I think this is like famously one of the most fast-paced movies relative to the time that it's premiering. I actually felt like, you know, the Force Awakens was fairly fast-paced as well. And of course, there's that whole conversation about the first third of Rise of Skywalker. I liked the pacing here. I've heard what you have said about the trench run stuff. That it is, it's not. It obviously has that frenetic, dramatic energy. But there's less of the sort of, I don't know how to describe it. There's less of this like human drama that is like keeping you on the edge of your seat. It's a little bit more sort of formulaic, classic, you know, dog fighting. You know, it almost feels like a video game once you get into the trench run itself. And of course, there's, you know, it famously becomes many video games after that. But like, yeah, it fits into that slot of like side scroller video game. In a way that the rest of the movie doesn't really fit into sort of an archetypal like video game slot. And I guess what I'm saying is it becomes familiar. And I don't know if this is because I'm watching it, you know, now, or because this is how some people might have actually felt in 77. But like, I don't know, the rest of it, that sort of discovery and exploration and the unfurling of this universe certainly feels faster and more interesting than the sort of the final battle.
I would completely agree. And I think that another problem for me personally is that all of the pilots look the same. Like they're all white dudes and, you know, with many of them with dark hair. Some of them have mustaches. One of them is a little chubbier. But, you know, it's genuinely hard for me to tell them apart. So it's hard for me to get invested or understand who just died. The only one I can tell is Wedge, but that's only because Wedge Antilles is my beloved.
Wait, so you can't tell Biggs?
I mean, I can tell Biggs, but Actually, no, I kind of struggled
to
tell.
He's the one
Biggs.
With the mustache. He gets a whole scene before they take off.
There's another one with a mustache.
He gets
the whole scene
with Luke before they take off where he says, it'll be just like Beggar's Canyon back home. And
yeah,
like,
well, I know Biggs, but...
You're saying you don't recognize him in the ship when it cuts to him.
Yes, that is correct. The only reason I know Biggs in the ship when it cuts to him is because I have seen this movie many times and I know he dies.
Right. I mean, he's like the last one there. So.
Yeah, he's the last one to die. But I think if I were watching this for the first time, having no context whatsoever, I would be like, wait, who's this guy with a mustache who seems to know Luke? Where did he come from? And then I would have been confused by all of these guys dying and I certainly would not have remembered which one was Biggs. I feel very confident in that. Sorry, Biggs. But
I mean, it is interesting how, think about this type of scene in other movies. There's usually more of a buildup of who the people are besides the main characters.
Right.
I guess not so much in Star Wars in the sense that, like, you don't really know who any of the X-Wing pilots are in The Force Awakens either. And you don't really know anything about, you know, Zev Seneska and, you know, Wes Janson in Empire Strikes Back. I mean, nobody knew those names from just watching the movie. So it's not necessarily something that Star Wars does a lot, but I feel like in storytelling in general, when you have that big final battle, you generally have a better sense of who the other people are around the main character. They've generally established that to a greater degree.
Yeah, It seems very rushed, like it comes from nowhere.
And look, it's a short movie, you know, it's a very tight movie. This isn't a TV show or a novel where they can give you several pages of backstory about each of the secondary characters.
Right. And I mean, that's why, you know, we have books and comics and things like From a Certain Point of View. So it's not that I don't understand. It's just that I personally find it boring. And there's a story I like to tell about my mom, whom I love and who I agree with on pretty much all pop culture things, except she doesn't like Star Wars, which is, you know, ridiculous.
Big yikes. And,
yeah, I know. So she saw Star Wars, the first one, episode 4, A New Hope, in theaters in 1977 when she was a teenager, and she fell asleep during it, specifically once the third act starts in the Death Star trench run. And every single time that she has seen A New Hope since then, she has fallen asleep. And honestly, at this point, I kind of find it like impressive that she manages to fall asleep pretty much at the same time every time. When I was in college, I think I forced her to watch it again. And I was like, this time you're gonna make it through. You're gonna do it. You're going to go all the way to the end. And she, during the first two thirds, was like, yeah, wait, this is better than I'm remembering. This is super interesting. I'm into it. I think I'll stay awake this time. And then I look over during the trench run scene and she's asleep.
Oh, no.
Yeah.
So, have you tried like just showing her the third act of the movie? Like,
I haven't.
Just start it with the third act?
Maybe it's like Pavlovian now. Like, she fell asleep in 1977 during the trench run. And now every time it starts, she just has no choice. But I think... I understand that because in 1977, I'm not saying I would have fallen asleep in the movie theater because, I mean, for me, it would have been too loud. But I can understand finding that part of the movie kind of boring. And then I also don't really like the ending where they get the medals. I think it's pretty silly. Yeah, so the third act, like, I get it. It doesn't really do it for me. And I don't think that would have turned me off from the movie in watching it for the first time in 1977. But I do understand how one could conceivably fall asleep during that part.
Yeah, the medal ceremony thing is interesting because I think in a lot of movies you would end with, you know, Luke getting out of the X-Wing back at Yavin 4 base, Han running over, you know, maybe they include the part where 3PO says, you know, I'm happy to, you know, help fix R2 however I can. And then, you know, maybe you end on a hug there. And to a certain extent, that's what Rise of Skywalker did, although I guess not technically the ending, but we won't talk about that. But yeah, like a lot of movies don't have a long sort of denouement. And yet this one has very deliberately doesn't just say like they won and they're, you know, reunited as friends again. It's like they won, the reunited as friends again, and they're being celebrated by this organization. And it almost feels like it's just an excuse to get them all up there on that platform, standing there, you know, looking directly at the camera, which of course they do in Return of the Jedi as well, and to a lesser extent in Empire Strikes Back, where they're looking out of the ship, but they have those closing shots of like all the characters together. And it's almost like this was just an excuse to give us that shot of them sort of looking happy and standing up on the stage there. But I guess I hadn't really thought about whether I liked the medal ceremony, but it does certainly seem a bit superfluous because you've already got like, okay, they survive, like they're reunited again. That we've already gotten that.
Yeah. And I also don't think Han deserves a medal, honestly. Like,
oh, now that's got to be a Hoth takes episode on its own. That honestly, yeah, is one of your Hother takes, because
it is,
I mean, he did save Luke Skywalker's life. I don't think there's a Death Star, you know, torpedo shot without Han Solo.
Well, no, but to be maybe then, and this is an even Hother take, maybe neither of them should have gotten a medal.
Well, is this just that you don't like medals? Were you one of those like kids who like wanted the soccer trophy even when you lost?
No, mostly because I didn't play soccer.
Okay, fair enough.
No, it is not because I am anti-medal. I think, and this is probably unfair for me to say because I am looking at it now within the context of the larger universe and not as its own movie, that was the first. So within the larger universe, I mean, I guess I don't really see why they take a big pause to give medals to these two guys when there have been other rebels just as helpful to the rebellion. And you know, maybe they didn't get medals because they died, like the Rogue One squadron.
Well, yeah, I mean, if this is a Jyn Erso was robbed, you know, no, criticism, like, I mean,
she died.
I mean, listen, like, I in universe, I understand the objection of why celebrate these people but not other people, including the Rogue One crew. But out of universe, if we're just looking at this movie, like, they didn't exist yet. And yeah, these people had just done something truly heroic. And, you know, literally rebellions are built on hope. The idea there is it's not just about how many weapons you have. It's about how motivated you feel. And this was an attempt to motivate people and to give them the sense that if they were in that situation, maybe they would have done the same thing if they had the opportunity.
Even though I believe the medal scene is superfluous, I will say I do appreciate that it is the only scene in the entire movie where Leia has normal hair. She has a nice little braid thing going on instead of the two buns. And she's also not wearing that horrible white frock thing. So worth it for her fashion upgrade alone and for Luke's puffy jacket that's like a sort of neon yellow Luke Skywalker fashion icon.
And give R2 a medal too. Come on.
Yes, of course. Speaking of R2, I would like to wish a happy pride to R2-D2 and C-3PO. Truly one of the greatest Star Wars couples of all time. They just have such a fun dynamic in this movie, and that you can appreciate both as the first movie ever and within the larger universe. Like, they're such an old married couple, and 3PO's constantly nagging him, but also, you know, they love each other. And so you, Eric, as an R2-T2 stan, do you think that he got enough love in this movie?
Well, I mean, you can never give him enough love. Like I said, I would have given him a medal. I do think that for different reasons, R2 and 3PO are some of the most successful storytelling in the movie. With R2, it's that he doesn't speak English. With 3PO, it's that he doesn't have a dynamic face. And yet in both cases, you know exactly who they are and what they're thinking at every moment. With R2, it's the expressiveness of the beeps, and it is the surprising amount of physical comedy and physical expression that he's able to do. 3PO, it is Anthony Daniels' performance, and also to some degree, the limited mobility, but they are so successful as characters with such fundamental limitations on each of them, even if the limitations are different. And it is, to me, one of the best examples of the brilliance of this movie. There are other things that the movie does well with certain constraints. These constraints in particular are just really fascinating to me as character constraints and largely surpassed. I mean, the characters surpass them, and you're able to feel this connection to them despite the fact that one of them can't talk and one of them can barely move. I would say that they are really phenomenally successful characters in this movie.
Yeah, I hadn't thought of it that way, but that's a really good point, especially for an audience watching it for the first time. They're right. Such a fun little introduction to the universe, and they explain so much about it, and, you know, explain the way droids work, and they are really, really effective characters and just so much fun. So I love them in this movie. I think they're great. Very funny, but also, as you mentioned, just really good at bringing the viewer into this universe.
Yeah, and with no history. I mean, every time we see droids after A New Hope, we have some context for understanding how they move and how they talk and all that stuff. They had to do that with none of that benefit in this movie, and it still worked.
Yeah. Other extras to discuss. I have to discuss Carrie Fisher's performance. I love Carrie Fisher, as listeners know. But, you know, this is not the best acted role. And there are a lot of things about Princess Leia in this movie that are pretty funny. Like the hair, obviously. The accent, like, what is that accent? And how it completely disappears in the next two movies. Very funny. And I feel comfortable making fun of this because Carrie herself often made fun of Princess Leia and, you know, kind of the expectations that were put upon her as an actress by George Lucas, for A New Hope in particular. One of my favorite stories about behind the scenes is that she wasn't allowed to wear a bra as Princess Leia because George Lucas was like, there are no bras in space, which is just hilarious. Like, you have droids, but you can't have bras in space. And his argument was that the vacuum, because of the vacuum, you know, the bra would strangle you.
But they have artificial gravity. Like, that never made sense. Like, what?
It's absolutely ridiculous. And so Carrie Fisher always said that in her obituary, she would want it to be said that she died strangled by her own bra, because of that ridiculous explanation. So I think that a lot of kind of silly expectations were put upon her character. And upon Carrie Fisher, who was 19 at the time. And that's just, I look upon it with humor because that's how Carrie herself looked upon it. But I think if I didn't look upon it with humor, it would really annoy me.
Yeah, I've heard it said, and I don't know if she said this or if other people said this, that the accent was just her, you know, how you talk as a junior aristocrat when you are in aristocratic circles. And after this movie, she's not really around imperial leadership anymore and doesn't have to sort of put on this air to stand toe-to-toe with them. Obviously, sort of a retcon there, but like, to me, when I watch it now, the accent doesn't bother me because I'm thinking about that retcon. I don't know how I would have felt or how I did feel the first time I saw it, because the other thing is, you know, she has the accent in this movie, but then later she doesn't. But you don't, if you watch it in that order, it doesn't seem as weird to you. It would be weirder if she didn't have it in this movie and she did have it in the next one, if it came out of nowhere. Whereas the other way around, you're not really thinking about it by the time you get to The Empire Strikes Back. You sort of have other things on your mind.
Yeah, that is a fair point. And I know that retcon as well. It just, I still think it's funny.
Yeah.
I will say that I do appreciate Leia in this movie as being very sarcastic. She has so many great lines, like, "Aren't you a little short for a stormtrooper?" And my personal favorite, "Into the garbage chute, flyboy." Which is just a great thing to say to someone in general, like, that you disagree with. Like, if someone has a really bad take, just say to them, "Into the garbage chute, flyboy."
I mean, that's what I say whenever I open Twitter. So,
yeah, exactly. It's perfect. So I think one of my struggles with Leia as a character overall is that I feel like I, as the viewer, kind of have to give her more depth than the movies give her, because a lot of what we had discussed earlier, like how she's been a part of the rebellion for years, like, that's not touched upon at all in this movie. And it is to a degree in other Star Wars media, but, you know, in a perfect world we would have a Leia focal point movie, but this is not a perfect world.
No, it certainly is not.
So is there anything else you would like to add to our discussion about A New Hope?
No, I think we hit the big things. I mean, it's really hard to talk about this movie, especially this movie, as if we haven't seen it before, or, you know, in a different context. But I think the bottom line is that it was really successful in a lot of ways, not only for its time, but today it still holds up. And it's rare to be able to say that about a movie like this.
Yeah, it definitely does still hold up. And I'm really looking forward to watching Empire for the Hoth Takes podcast, because, I mean, obviously it's the best Star Wars movie. And that's not even really a Hoth take to say, but A New Hope, like, it holds up. It's a fun movie. Looking at it both within the larger universe and pretending that we had never seen it before. So overall, good job, 1977 George Lucas. I bestow upon you my approval 44 years later.
And with that, we can officially say that Star Wars Episode 4, A New Hope, is a good movie. We have just gotten the Grace Seeger's seal of approval. 44 years of praise and applause and congratulations and appellations have been confirmed. It is true. It was not a fluke. All those people were right. Grace Seeger's has said so.
This is the medal ceremony.
This is the medal ceremony of Star Wars.
This is the superfluous medal ceremony of Star Wars. My approval. You're welcome, America. All right, guys. Thank you so much for listening. If you want to share your thoughts about this episode or about A New Hope as a whole, or suggest topics for future shows, you can email us at hottakes@gmail.com or find us on Twitter @hottakes. I'm @Grace_Seegers on Twitter. Eric is @Eric Geller. And Haley is @Burdenator. Kaylee made our incredible logo and banner art, and Eric edited the show and put together our music. Although for legal purposes, we should note that all Star Wars themes and sound effects are the intellectual property of Lucasfilm. You can find a complete archive of past episodes on our website, hottakes.wordpress.com. If you like the show, share it with a friend. Just tell them to subscribe on iTunes, Google Podcasts, Spotify, or Stitcher, or wherever you find your podcasts. We'll see you next time. May the Force be with you.